BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Every good pilgrimage should start like this. Slant afternoon sunlight, uneasy crows startling from a tree, the bold crimson door of a pub. I'm not going in, but I'm starting uphill, past the fox and goose in Hebden Bridge, nested at the bottom of the road that climbs and climbs towards Heptonstall. It always looks as if it's leaning towards the town, mildly drunken. Below me, black chimneys and rooftops. Above me, spring making all the leaf tips tingle. I'm setting off to visit a poet's grave, the final resting place of Sylvia Plath, but the day doesn't feel restful. As I pass, someone wanders outside the pub to smoke, resting on the lintel to light up, protecting a small flame with cupped hands, and I think of late nights inside its warren of rooms, eating samosas at closing time with Ben and Claire and Andrew and Joe, or the lunchtime when I drank a treacly half of stout with Gloria, the day we came to remember a lost friend. There's melancholy and promise in the bricks of Hebden. I can't walk here without feeling it, an ache in the bones, a quickening of the stride. I could take the woodland path up towards the moors, but I've chosen the slog of the road because I want to tire myself out fast. Sometimes it's good to be exhausted, to walk monotonously, letting your thoughts intrude. Steady steps, metre added onto metre. Walking is the rhythm of poetry. I want to feel my lungs burn. As I climb, I think of Norman McCaig, how he captured the joy and toil of uphill walking so perfectly in his poem Climbing Sullivan, where he says, "My lungs say no, but down and down this treadmill hill must go." Then, because winter doesn't feel so far behind me and the sun isn't warming me as much as it should, by the time I reach the cobbles that mark the threshold of Heptonstall and my steps begin to falter, I'm thinking of Sylvia Plath herself and her piece Walking in Winter, these particular lines. I can taste the tin of the sky, the real tin thing. Winter dawn is the colour of metal. The trees stiffen into place like burnt nerves. Yes, the real tin thing. Even in April, I know what she means. The light still slightly metallic. And since I'm here to see her grave, I pretend it's this sky, this precise sky she was thinking of, as well she might have been, because she once stood under its cloak too. Heptonstall is an old world held in a new world. The past feels very present. The street winds severely, the houses cling on tight. The windows are small, the roofs are sunken. There is something beautiful about them, but also something persistent. They have endured. Somewhere higher up the road is Lumbank, an 18th century mill owner's house, former home of the poet Ted Hughes, the man Plath married, now an Arvon Writing Centre, and a place I strongly connect to my own love of writing poetry. Lumbank sits in 20 acres of steep woodland. It is all book-filled rooms and creaking staircases, all flagstones and ghosts. I'm not going that far. I'm turning off into the churchyard here in Heptonstall, the trepanned skull of the old church, the open to anything let's be having you brickwork, the solemn footpaths, the strangely modern large graveyard beyond it where Sylvia Plath is buried and where countless admirers of her work and what she stood for have come to pay their respects or enact their complex idea of retribution. The surname Hughes has been repeatedly hacked away from her headstone. Some Plath devotees were upset that she'd been buried close to Hughes's Yorkshire birthplace, an area he once called his tuning fork, rather than near her own roots back in America. But the name chiselling is the most publicised intervention. It is appropriate, this image of the wording of her grave being changed, because Plath's is an overwritten history, seldom considered in isolation from her husband's, until the publication of more recent, exhaustive biographies like Heather Clark's book Red Comet. Plath met Hughes in 1956 at a party after she came to England to study at Cambridge University. The couple married 4 months later and moved into a home near Dartmoor to bring up their two children, Frieda and Nicholas. When the marriage imploded, Plath moved back to London but became severely depressed. I didn't approach her poetry for many years because I had met so many others who seemed to feel an ownership of her, her life, her tragic suicide, her turbulent and destructive relationship. Everyone has an idea of Plath, and her grave has become a focus for some of the arguments about her marriage, her death, her legacy. I walk past rows and rows of modern-looking headstones. This isn't the first time I've been here, but I always have difficulty finding what I'm looking for. Plath's grave is encountered when you least expect it. This place is such a site of pilgrimage for poetry lovers. It's almost possible to forget all the many others who are buried here, all the relatives and strangers and friends. In the BBC drama series Happy Valley, the indomitable police officer Catherine Kaywood is shown in this graveyard, in vigil at the grave of her daughter Becky, also claimed by suicide. This place is a cache of mythology, ancient and contemporary. Even on a quiet day, you're aware of being scrutinised. Perhaps it's the memory of TV cameras. Perhaps it's just the singular magpie who hops along, keeping his distance from me, resigned to his place as a lazy metaphor for sorrow. Sometimes I worry that Plath's name has become shorthand for sorrow too. In 1988, the LA Times reported, "Even in death, Sylvia Plath is not at peace." The grave had become a battleground for those with strong opinions about her status as a victim of abuse. Nowadays, it seems at first sight a grey grave like any other, with the usual offerings, fresh flowers and shrivelled ones, petals lifted away by the wind. But alongside the floral tributes, there are trinkets and figurines, pens and notes, pebbles and shells, offerings to her and the impact of her poetry and prose, her passage through this landscape. When she first visited West Yorkshire in 1956, Plath told her friend Ellie Friedman that she felt very tall and blonde and foreign, and that she was aware of being observed, scrutinised from behind twitching curtains. She was staying at the Beacon, the house where Ted's parents, Billy and Edith Hughes, lived, and it had expansive views across the Calder Valley, the Pennine Hills. In letters to her mother, Aurelia Plath, she described the mercurial weather. "A wicked north wind is whipping a blowing rain against the little house." The view from her window was unlike anything she'd encountered before. As she put it, it was an incredible wild green landscape of bare hills. Her words sound almost contradictory, but I think I know what she means as I stand here. There is something both abundant and barren about these high places. I walk through them as she must have, incredulous and daunted. Yes, Plath wandered around the 13th century church that would one day host her own grave. She has a poem called November Graveyard, ostensibly inspired by the cemetery at nearby Haworth in Bronte country, but it bears a resemblance to Heptonstall too. To quote from it, "At the essential landscape, stare, stare, till your eyes foist a vision dazzling on the wind. Whatever lost ghosts flare, damned, howling in their shrouds across the moor, rave on the leash of the starving mind which peoples the bare room, the blank, untenanted air." I find that image of the mind, hungry, straining on its tethers, lunging out at something beyond it, incredibly poignant and disturbing. I'm also drawn to her use of untenanted to describe the air, because it often strikes me that there is something strangely untenanted about the churchyard at Heptonstall, for all it bears the traces of so many people's passage. You can feel very alone here, even at the side of a grave which has been so visited, so marked. When we were 17, me and my friend Bex went to see the film of Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes' lives together at the Arty Cinema in Sheffield. We felt faintly glamorous in the velvet seats of the showroom, stifling the sounds of eating popcorn, watching Gwyneth Paltrow and Daniel Craig acting the parts of famous poets. We giggled, half nervous, but the story hushed us. We both wept at Plath's farewell to her two children, the decisive moment of her suicide, which didn't feel decisive at all, of course, but like the end of a very long, very bright corridor, a hotel corridor perhaps, where all the other doors had shut with a slam as she passed them. When I cried, it wasn't just for Plath's story, but for the fact that it could be narrated at all, that it should be storied and repeated and debated, a source of romantic fantasy and bitter acrimony. On the train on the way back, there were no seats, and we decided to sneak into first class, waiting to be ejected, watching the outskirts of Sheffield and Chesterfield through the grimy window, and the commuters who seemed ludicrously to project a sense of knowing that they belonged. We were small market town teenagers who liked to paint our nails black and drink 2-for-1 orange reef at the weekends and break our own hearts with resolute regularity. Plath's iconography spoke to us, the image of tortured genius. But we also felt uncomfortable about it, about her public ownership. We felt like voyeurs. That's when I first picked up a copy of Plath's book Ariel, and began to work my way through her poetry in a non-linear fashion, marvelling at how she could make the known world strange, a yew tree, the sombre presence of the moon, the cry of a newborn. Her images spoke to me when I was still trying to work out what poems were and why I loved them so much. The poet Don Patterson describes poetry as a singular art in the way we can utterly imbibe it and memorize it. He says, a poem makes a fetish of its memorability. It does this because the one unique thing about our art is that it can be carried in your head in its original state, intact and perfect. We merely recall a string quartet or a film or a painting. Actually, at a neurological level, we're only remembering a memory of it, but our memory of the poem is the poem. Standing in front of Plath's wind-scoured grave, it strikes me that we've tried to treat her like a poem, to swallow her completely, as if she might live in all of us. The magpie hops off, and I let it go, hope it can dart into a different story, next to another of its kind, where the same bird can magically become an omen of good. The sun's hiding, and my shadow is barely perceptible. A blurred form. It is almost time to set off back down the hill.